You don't know Flag. You don't know Flag.
Welcome to You Don't Know Flag, a podcast full of stories about retro gaming, retro computing, video games, arcade games, and technology from a guy who was there and still is. My name is Rob O'Hara, but for the next 30 minutes, you can call me Flag.
Episode 5, Boss BBS.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 5 of You Don't Know Flack. It's been a while since I've done a new episode. Several reasons for that. Most of them are things you probably wouldn't care about. The server moved, as you all know. Those of you that have been following, there is no more tech.robohara.com. Everything has moved to robohara.com. While I was in the middle of that, my server got hacked, which was a wonderful experience. And that story doesn't fit the scope of the podcast, but suffice it to say that that was a lovely experience. So I got to deal with that. And since the last episode, the family and I, we went on vacation. So we were out of the house for a little over a week, and while we were gone, the air conditioner broke in our house, and so we've had people fixing the air conditioner, and so on and so forth. There's an entire list of excuses I could give about where I've been, but the important thing is that I'm here now, and you're here, and so we're going to get things back on track with episode 5. This episode is about Boss BBS, which was a bulletin board system I used to call back in the Commodore 64 days, and it's a fun little story, and it has a updated ending, something that's recently happened over the last 2 or 3 days. So since it's an update to one of my old stories, I thought I'd go ahead and kick things back off with the story of Boss BBS. I first got a Commodore 64 back in the summer or early fall of 1985. Our neighbor across the street had a Commodore 64. I'm pretty sure that's the first Commodore 64 I ever saw. They had Donkey Kong, the cartridge, and as a basis of comparison, I had Donkey Kong on the Atari 2600, which, if you've ever seen that, is really a horrible port of the game. And the Commodore 64 version is not that bad, especially, you know, to kids. I was 12 years old at the time, and it was a pretty impressive port. So I think Donkey Kong is what sold me on the Commodore 64. Now, before I had a Commodore, my dad had an Apple II computer, the Franklin Ace that I talked about. And before that, we had the TRS-80. And so growing up with those computers, I was brought in, I guess you could say, to, I guess I grew up around what we called the Wares scene and Wares trading, which was, Wares was obviously slang for software, and but it implied illegal copies. So Wares were copies of games. And back then, there was the internet has changed the way wares are traded today. In fact, the way that people trade wares today is almost an opposite of the way things worked back then. In the BBS days, there was a pretty strong emphasis on trading. On the internet now, you're not really out anything. I mean, I guess theoretically you could say bandwidth, but bandwidth is not really, it's so bountiful, I guess you could say, that it doesn't really hurt you if someone downloads something and they don't upload anything. But back then, software was about trading. And so I had two good friends of mine, Andy and Jeff, and both of them had Commodore 64s before I did. And so even before I had a Commodore, I started trading software. I had got copies of Andy's games, and then I would go to Jeff's house and I would trade him those games for his games, and then I would take his games back and go back and trade him back with Andy for more games. And so even though I'm trading games between these two people, I've kind of positioned myself as a middleman, so I'm getting copies of both of their games, you know. So I started building a software collection even before I had a Commodore. I met Jeff at the beginning of seventh grade, which is the summer of 85, and I didn't get my Commodore for a couple months past that. But anyway, trading software back then really took place in two different ways. It took place over the phone, and it took place in person. And actually, there were other things, like I remember trading games with a few people through the mail, and you know, a few other things. But basically, you could either you know, get with somebody in person and copy discs back and forth, or you could trade over the phone. Now, in 1985, almost everybody I knew had 300 baud modems. There may have been a few people that had 1200 in my circle, but for the most part, we all had 300 baud, and the main reason was because of price. I remember my first 300 baud modem, which I got right around when I got my Commodore, maybe that fall, cost about $75 for 300 baud, and a 1200 baud modem was a little over $200. So, you know, just for the ability to be able to connect to other people, or you know, and being that young, most of us had 300 baud modems. Now, trading games. Now, a fact that I love is Commodore diskettes. A Commodore disk holds 664 blocks, but when you convert that over to K, a Commodore disk converts to about, I believe it's about 180K. Now, to upload, now think about 180K in today's, like on the internet, I mean, there are lots of people who have signatures that are larger than 180K. And 300 baud to transfer 180K or a full disk took several hours. So trading over the phone lines at 300 baud was painfully slow. You know, everybody who traded software back then has stories of trading, you know, starting an upload and then going to bed, or starting uploads or downloads on the way to school. One of my favorite tricks was I would start, you know, something downloading on the way to school. This was later. And then, you know, during lunch, I would run home and flip the disk over and start something else downloading and go back to school. So, but 300 baud trading was really slow. So the, if you could meet with somebody in person, whether it was at school or meeting with them after school or whatever, you could trade disks and get a lot of software in a short amount of time. But you know, being 12, 13 years old at the time, it was difficult to do that. It was easy if you set up trades with schoolmates and you could go visit them after school or whatever, but a lot of times you would meet these people on BBSs or whatever, and they would live on the other side of town, and then you know, getting your parents to drive you over there or their parents or whatever became a logistical problem. So anyway, you know, I get my 300 baud modem and I start trading, doing the same thing I had done between Jeff and Andy, but just on a larger scale, and I start doing it with BBSs. So I get these lists of BBSs, and, you know, BBSs that have wares, and I start calling them, and I specifically sought out BBSs that were in different social circles. So I would find, like, you know, two different boards that didn't have any common users. And, you know, using those early programs that I got from Jeff and Andy, I would call, you know, BBS number one and upload something from Jeff and Andy's collection and download a new game. And then I would call BBS number two and upload what I had got from BBS number one, but download something from BBS number two and then send that back to BBS number one, and so on and so forth. And then multiply this by probably 30 BBSs. So it was almost like trading software was a means to itself. In other words, when I first started trading software, and trading wares, I wanted to get games because I wanted to play these games, you know. But as time went on, and this was, you know, ultimately over a series of years, almost 10 years, well, longer if you go into the PC days. But at first I traded software to get games so I could play games, but eventually what it evolved into is I traded software just to build a software collection. So like I said, the actual, I guess you could say that the game to me became the trading of games. You know, building a collection of software was more important to me than actually playing the games at a certain point. So, like I said, in the early days, I spent a lot of time actually playing the games, but, in the BBS days, you know, back in the Commodore, the Apple and stuff, there was no such thing as, and even in the DOS days, there was no multitasking. So when you were uploading a game or downloading a game, you know, your computer was dedicated to that. And like I said, we're talking, you know, hours at a time, sometimes trading these full disk games. So you did have to kind of, you know, the trading part, if you were trying to stay active and getting the latest software and trading between these people, then you didn't necessarily have a lot of time to play all these games. So anyway, I started calling all these different BBSs, and one of the BBSs I ran across was called the Boss BBS, and the sysop was a guy named Boss, or the Boss. And a lot of BBSs on the Commodore, nobody had hard drives back then. I mean, they did, but I didn't know anybody that had a hard drive. Hard drives were really expensive. I know I'm kind of getting sidetracked here, but I actually did know people that had a 20 meg hard drive for the Commodore, and I think those retail, they started at around about $800. So I didn't know anybody that had a hard drive for many, many years. But you could tell the people that their BBSs were set up for file transfers because they would have multiple disk drives. And the Boss's BBS actually had three disk drives. The first one was, you know, the system that everything ran off of that drive. And then there was a second drive that was just full of programs you could download. And the third drive was full. It was just an empty disk where you could upload files. And so, I did, you know, what I had done it at several other BBSs. I would call the Boss's BBS and, you know, upload. I'd uploaded as much as I could, and downloaded from him. And, the Boss had pretty good games, you know, he had a pretty good collection of software. And so, you know, I guess, at some point I catch the Boss's attention, you know, he sees that I'm, you know, really good uploading and stuff. And, so he asked me if I want to come to his house and trade software in person. Now, one funny thing is, you know, we got our TRS-80, gosh, when I was like, you know, 6 years old, 7 years old, maybe. So I grew up behind a keyboard, and I've always been a fairly literate guy, and so when you combine those things, my typing skill and my, you know, early vocabulary and stuff, I fooled a lot of people with my age. A lot of people online thought that I was much older than I really was. And so, you know, when these people would set up trades with me, like, hey, you know, do you want to come over and trade software? And I would say, yeah, that'd be fine, you know, and we would set up a time. And they had no idea that I was so young. In fact, most of them had no idea that I couldn't drive. And they were surprised to see, you know, my parents pull up and to see me hop out of the car and them to drop me off. And I would have to set a time for them to come back, you know, and pick me up. So then that's what happened with the Boss. The boss invited me over to trade software. And I took my big boxes of discs and went over. And his wife was a German lady, and she was really nice. In fact, I remember the first time I came over, she had baked a big thing of cookies, and I can remember the smell of these chocolate chip cookies as I went in, and we played games and copied games and stuff, and we hit it off pretty well. The boss was much older than I was at the time. I was probably 12. I was still 12 years old, I guess, the first time I visited the boss. And the boss was in his late 20s or maybe 30 years old. So, you know, in the real world, a 30-year-old is not going to hang out, you know, with a 12-year-old. But back in the computer, you know, early BBS days and stuff, it really wasn't that uncommon. I mean, that's a pretty wide range. But, you know, adults traded games with kids. Really, everybody was just interested in the software, you know. So the age discrepancy didn't really matter that much. But so anyway, the boss and I, we, you know, trade software, and he sees that that I have this, I'm, you know, building a pretty large software library, and I'm building a reputation as being a guy who, you know, gets new programs and is a good trader and stuff. And so we kind of built this relationship. He gives me access on his BBS, and, you know, I keep him supplied with software. And I went over to his house two or three times that I can remember. And one of the last times I went over there, the boss said that he had come up with an extra 1200 baud modem. And, you know, like I said, I was still at 300 baud. So 1200 baud is obviously four times faster. And he said, you know, if I wanted to keep uploading software with him, you know, keep trading with him or whatever, that I should upgrade. And the number sticks with me. But I think at the time that you could buy a 1200 baud modem, the retail was about $169, and he offered me this modem for $75. And it was right before Christmas, and so I had begged my parents, you know, for an early Christmas present, and my dad really understood. Not that my mom, you know, wouldn't have helped me out on something like that, but my dad, being a computer guy, I'm sure he understood, you know, the need for hardware, the need for upgrades. So, so my parents hooked me up, and you know, I bought this 1200 baud modem. So, you know, at that point, I guess I should say, I should throw this in, that when Jeff and Andy first started me off with my Commodore, you know, software collection, I kind of made a deal to them, but it was more of a promise to myself, in that anybody that helped me along my path, I guess you would say, or whatever, helped me, you know, building my collection, especially in the early days, that I would always take care of those people. I remember telling Jeff that he would never have to go out and look for software, that I would always, you know, as anything that I had, he could always have, you know. I mean, Jeff was a personal friend of mine too, but it was just kind of the idea that, you know, these are the people that helped me get started. And Boss was one of the people that helped me get started. And so I kind of took that attitude with him. And soon, you know, I had really bypassed what Boss's BBS had to offer. Boss's BBS was a BBS with wares, but it was not a wares BBS. The difference being, you know, Boss's BBS had message areas where people talked, and it had online games and little things like that, you know. So it wasn't just about trading software, where after a while, you know, especially once I went to 1200 baud, I started gravitating away from BBSs like that, and I started moving towards BBSs that were just dedicated to trading software. Those were boards that typically had, you know, bigger storage areas, like maybe bigger drives and things like that. So so even though I started, you know, bypassing the limitations of Boss BBS or whatever, I always kept him hooked up. Anytime I got new games, I would always go upload things to Boss BBS, even though, you know, I wasn't really getting anything back from his board at this point. Now, one of the last times I saw the boss, he showed me a spiral notebook that he had that was filled with these numbers, and he called them codes. And I didn't really know what they were, and that whole scene was kind of new to me. But what they were calling card codes, or just called codes in, you know, BBS slang. Sometimes it was spelled codes with a Z on the end so that you would know. But basically what these were stolen calling card codes. They were access codes to PBXs or other, you know, MCI calling card codes, but they were essentially what they were stolen codes that you could call long distance with. Now, part of the whole BBS wares scene, if you will, is that every scene ultimately would become stagnant. There were only so many people trading software, and ultimately, you know, eventually everybody would have what everybody else had. So to get new software into the scene, you had to call long distance and call, especially if, you know, like I lived in Oklahoma, if you wanted new software, you were going to have to call one of the coasts. The BBSs in California, the BBSs in New York, the BBSs in Florida. Those were the places that were getting new software, and Oklahoma was not a place that was getting new software. So, you know, if you wanted new stuff, you had to call long distance. And so I remember the boss showing me this, and at that time, calling long distance wasn't really a big deal for me. I mean, I didn't feel like I needed to call long distance, and there were enough other people doing it that I didn't, you know, need to do it or whatever. I'm not even sure why I saw that, or, you know, I don't remember him like sitting down and explaining it to me, but it must have been something where I saw it and I knew enough about what was going on to know what it was. So anyway, you know, we go forward. I think we jump forward a couple of years. You know, I mean, by this point, I've been calling BBSs, Commodore BBSs, for a couple of years now, and you know, like I said, I've kind of moved up and away from Boss's BBS, but I always, you know, I still kept him connected. And one day I come home from school and I call Boss's BBS and it doesn't answer. And this doesn't really raise any alarms to me at that point. You know, BBSs were, you know, these computers that, I mean, they ran on computers that didn't multitask, and you know, you had to have a modem, and Commodores were, you know, kind of, you know, they overheated fairly easily, and, you know, there could be any number of reasons why BBS wouldn't answer. But, you know, as the night goes on, the BBS is still not answering. And then on the 10 o'clock news, I hear the boss's real name, which was Bruce, broadcast on the news, and they happen to mention that Bruce had been arrested. And let me tell you what. If you want to talk about a 14-year-old kid at this point, basically crapping his pants, this is a problem. because, you know, at this, I mean, first of all, most BBSs had a validation tool where whenever you called, you had to give your phone number, and then either the sysop would either call you back voice to validate you to, you know, to find out you are who you say you are, or it would actually call your computer back, and then you could answer, you know, your computer would answer. But, you know, so most BBSs had your real phone number and usually your real name. You know? So the first thing I'm thinking is, oh, crap, I'm going to jail. You know, the police are going to see all the, you know, programs that I've uploaded over the years, and that I'm going to jail big time. Now, most of any of you who know me know that I am a pack rat. And the next day, there was an article about the boss being arrested in the newspaper, and I still have that newspaper article. And I'm just going to read that article to you here. I'm going to, for respect of the boss, I'm going to edit out he and his wife's real names. But other than that, this is the article that ran in the Daily Oklahoman. An Oklahoma City couple are computer hackers who used their home computer to illegally obtain information from a long-distance telephone company, prosecutors alleged Thursday. The boss, has his name, and his wife were charged in Oklahoma County District Court with a felony count of conspiring to violate the state's computer crime law and a felony count of violating the law. The two who work at a bakery face up to 20 years in prison and $105,000 in fines on the two counts, a prosecutor said. The two are accused of using their home computer and a telephone to get into U.S. Sprint's credit card computer network, then search for authorization codes, nine-digit numbers used by customers to charge long-distance calls. U.S. Sprint reported it detected use of the personal computer August 7th and was able to trace the call Monday. The computer placed 351 calls between 12:29 p.m. and 4:51 p.m. Monday, as often as once every 27 seconds, in its systematic search for codes, authorities said. Assistant District Attorney Brad Miller said, "Some computer hackers are known to sell legally obtained or illegally obtained codes. At least 100 codes were found Wednesday in a search of the boss's home." And then it has his home in. So this is really, really bad. It's bad for the boss, obviously. It's bad for anyone who's a member of the boss BBS. And it's bad for the scene as a whole, you know, because there are a lot of people that are doing this. And, you know, for at least a month after the boss got busted, I hid my discs. All my games, I hid them under my bed. And I'm sure that would have done me a lot of good, you know, if the FBI had come and kicked in my front door, you know. And every time the phone rang, you know, you'd get that pit in your stomach, like you're in trouble at school. And, you know, very fortunately for me, nothing ever came of that whole, experience. There were, a few phone calls made that made me a little nervous. But you know, as far as I can tell, you know, the FBI never showed up at my door. Which was a good thing for me. And, you know, being 14, I'm not sure what would have happened to me anyway. But ultimately, it appears they weren't interested in the software thing at that point. And you got to remember, the Commodore, even, you know, more so then than now, was not really seen as a home computer. I know people like to think of it as, that it was an important computer or whatever. But to the majority of people, it was a, you know, game playing system that also happened to have a disk drive. It, you know, nobody had a Commodore at their place of business that I ever heard of. You know, everybody had Apples, and then, you know, soon everything switched to IBM. So, you know, there weren't a lot of people using Commodores at work. So anyway, you know, the years go by, and of course I'm a Commodore user for several more years, and eventually I moved to the PC and I called BBSs and stuff, and that's a lot of that, you know, it's all covered in Commodore. I never hear from the boss again, which is, you know, there's always that thing in the back of your head, like, well, you know what, you always wonder what happened. And, about, 1998 or so, I got an email from the boss, and it was a really short email, and it just basically said, "Hey, I don't know if you remember me, blah blah blah. You sound familiar, and I wanted to see, you know, how you're doing." And I never answered it. I never answered his email, and it's something I've regretted for a long time. But you know, in 1998. I was still doing some questionable computer-related activities, if that's a vague enough way to say it. But and you know, I was doing things on the computer, doing enough things that I was paranoid enough of, you know, people that weren't in my direct circle knowing what I was doing. And for somebody to come out of the blue that I hadn't talked to in almost, you know, 10 years, and the last time I talked to them that they had been arrested, this was not somebody that I was going to talk to. And so, you know, like I said, I regret it that I never, you know, that I didn't answer his email. But anyway, let's fast forward, and one of the reasons why this podcast is a little bit late is because as I started writing the outline for this, I I wanted to see if I could find the boss again. And I had tried, before I published Commodore, I tried finding boss, and I searched for his real name, and he has a fairly unique German last name, especially in this part of the country, you know. So I assume it's German. I don't know. It's an unusual last name. And so, and the funny thing is that I also know his brother's name, because his brother also ran a BBS. So I had searched for these, and all I could find was this one article about how they were pallbearers at a funeral. But I couldn't find, you know, any contact information for either one of these guys. And, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure that he would, you know, A, remember me, or B, want to talk to me. I mean, one thing I have found, and it's really interesting, is that when I find these old people that, you know, used to call BBSs, the younger they are, the more they want to talk to me and the more they remember. The people that were my age, that were, you know, teenagers, young teens or whatever, they, you know, they remember all these details and they want to talk and they want to find out, you know, what happened. But the guys that were older, and Boss being one, and Klaatu is a big example for me, because Klaatu was half of the OK Crackers with me, a Commodore cracking group that we ran for several years. And when I finally tracked down Klaatu, basically he said he remembered very little from that time. You know, most of the people I mentioned or stories I told, he had no recollection of. And it just struck me as really weird, because, you know, for me, it was such a big part of my, childhood, really my teen years. You know, this was big stuff for me. And so, it just really shocked me, I guess, that it wasn't as important to him as it was to me. And I got the same impression. I was afraid of the same thing with the boss, was that, you know, maybe he wouldn't remember me, or maybe he wouldn't, you know, remember those things. So anyway, but I looked for him before I published Commodore, and I wasn't able to find him. But, as I was finishing up this, the draft for this podcast, I looked for him again, and I was able to track him down. I found a family, a genealogy type page, and I saw that he's been remarried, and that gave me some different names to search on. And eventually I found him on MySpace. And I love when old BBS people and old computer people, you know, show up on MySpace, because I like that people, you know, have stuck with the hobby, you know, over the years. So anyway, I emailed the boss and, just kind of, you know, asked what happened and how things have gone and how his life has gone since that. And, you know, it's really unfortunate what happened to him, because, you know, you know, if you think about like the movie War Games, where, you know, everybody was, I mean, it's a goofy example, but if you think about, you know, how he was just, how David Lightman was just dialing in, and he just wanted to play games, and then, you know, he almost starts World War III. And obviously this isn't, you can't compare it on that scale, but, you know, we were all, you know, trading games. I mean, that's all they were, was games on these little computers, you know, and of course, and things escalated, you know, like, you know, well, this person might be calling long distance, or this person might be, you know, I never did this, but, I'm not being sarcastic either. I'm being serious. I never did this, but, I know people that had stolen credit cards and would actually, you know, card hardware or whatever to increase their BBS, or, so there were all these things that, that's credit card fraud is pretty bad, but, you know, as far as calling long distance, you know, and using these codes, I mean, it's bad, but, you know, it's hard to see ruining somebody's life over, you know. And from the emails that I got from the boss, that kind of sounds like that's what happened. I mean, he has a felony conviction now for computer crime, which in 1987 is bad, but today it's worse. You know, in 1987, there are still lots of places you could get a job that may or may not, you know, have computers in the office. But, you know, try getting a job today with a place, you know, and they do a background check and you have a felony conviction for computer crime, it's pretty tough to get a job. And it did not surprise me at all to learn that the boss has a job that is completely outside the computer industry and has very little to do with computers, you know. So, you know, it's a case of, it's hard to see that the punishment fit the crime in that deal. And like I said, I'm not trying to make light of the crime itself, you know. I mean, I'm sure it's serious, but it's hard to see how finding a way to make long distance calls for free in order to, you know, get games for your computer would put a mark on your record so black that you're excluded from a lot of jobs in the future, you know, for the rest of your life. So anyway, but you know what? The boss is still out there and he's still alive. And it's kind of a lot of us that were kids at the time, you know, I think we took a lot of risks and did a lot of goofy stuff and got away with a lot of stuff because of our age and because, you know, police weren't really knowledgeable about computer crime at that point. So, you know, we got away with a lot of stuff and there were a few unfortunate people that got caught, but anyway, so that's the story of the boss BBS. He had a good run and he got caught doing something bad and it stunk, but he's still out there and he's a happy guy. And actually we've made arrangements where I'm hoping to have lunch with the boss sometime next week, and it'll be the first time in 22 years that we've seen each other. So that should be kind of interesting. But anyway, that's the story of Boss BBS. And hopefully I'm going to get things back on track here. I'm always looking for show ideas. So if you have any show ideas, feel free to email them to me. You can always email me directly at robohara@robohara.com. And if you found the podcast, you know that the podcast has moved to www.robohara.com. There are there's an RSS feed on the right-hand side of the page if you want to subscribe to RSS. And also, later this week, I'm going to be setting up a mailing list where if you're old school, you don't like the RSS feeds, but you want to get emailed when there are podcast updates, then you can sign up to that mailing list. And when there are updates, I will email you. So, hey, you can't beat that. And it's all free. Why would you pay for this? That would be terrible. I would give refunds. If you send me money, I will send you money back. That's how bad this show is. So there you go. I will double your money back. No, I don't want to do that because people will be sending me money. So anyway, it is, you know what I should say, because you know what, I'm already over the 30-minute mark. So if you are still listening, then you deserve to be punished. August 9th, coming up, August 9th is OVGE, the Oklahoma Video Game Expo. It takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's taken place every year since 2003, except for last year. So 03, 04, 05, 06. There was no show last year. This show is going to be last year and this show's show combined. So it's like two shows, but on one day. So what a deal for you. If you want to come out, if you're a member of Digital Press, you want to come out, phosphor.fossils, there are a lot of moderators and ex-moderators will be there. Phosphor.fossils will be there. Icebreaker will be there. The owner and administrator of particles.org. I should plug, I'm going to plug everybody. Phosphor.fossils is the owner of thelogbook.com. That's with the word thelogbook.com, which is a great sci-fi slash gaming slash all different kinds of cool stuff there. Particles.org, which is our icebreaker site, is dedicated to retro computers. There's all kind of computer stuff, a great forum there as well. Gaporin, who's a buddy of ours from Digital Press, he's going to be there. Ubik Uberalis and Pantechnicon and 98 Pace Car and all the guys that you see on the forums, plus Crossbow, who puts on OVGE every year, is going to be there, of course. So if you want to come out and meet everybody, and there's going to be lots of stuff, lots of games to play. And, you know, last year I think there were close to 40 vendors. So it's a really good size show, yet it still kind of has that small show feel, and everybody's approachable. You can come out and, like I said, meet people, buy, sell stuff, you know, anything like that. So if you want to come out to OVGE this year, you go to OVGE.com, and you could get directions and find out more information there. And, you know, I'd like to do a show about video game expos, but I've only been to the OVGE shows, and last year I went to CGE, so I'm not really sure, you know, if I could put together enough stuff about that for a whole show. But I've got some ideas for I might be talking about arcade games. Oh, and that's another thing I should mention is I am nearing completion on my second book, which is called Invading Spaces, and that will debut at OVGE. So there's another reason to come out to the show this year. I'll be selling autographed copies of that for $50. Just kidding. I think copies will probably be the same as Commodore, and those should be $20. If you want to, Invading Spaces is about buying, selling, and collecting arcade games. So the actual subtitle is A Beginner's Guide to Buying, Selling, and Collecting Arcade Games. So if you've ever, you know, if you're interested in arcade games, but you're not really sure where to begin, this book is going to cover the basics of buying, selling, and collecting, oddly enough. It's not really a technical manual per se. It's more of like an instructional guide. It'll give you the basics of, you know, where to buy games, things to look for, stuff like that. Then, of course, there's a lot of goofy arcade, you know, type stories tossed in there in the middle too. So, I have done it once again. I have broken the 30-minute barrier by almost 50%. We're coming up on 45 minutes. So I'm going to wrap this up. I hope you enjoyed this one. Hopefully we will get back on track starting next month. I'm going to try and stick to the 1st and 15th. So look for a new show on August 1st. And that's the end. Boy, what a terrible ending. I got nothing. So tune in on the 1st, and I will have a new show and hopefully a better ending. Talk to you then.